Everybody would look at me very suspiciously and ask why I wanted to know who lived in the house and what I was going to do with this information, and was I going to take their names back to the United States with me. And then they would say, really, they had no time. They had to go to the fields to work, and maybe their neighbors would talk to me. And so I decided that the best thing to do was just go with them in the fields and help them out there. And that worked much better over time as I got to know some people well, that then built more trust, and I was more a person and less a strange curiosity.
Now, you spoke Nepali, but you didn't speak the native language of the people in the village.
Right.
What kind of impact did that have on your ability to communicate with them?
That was one of the hardest parts. And in the beginning, I tried to learn Yakuba, which is their local language, which is spoken by, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 people in the world, and it's an oral language. With the men, it was never a significant problem in my research because most men either had been to school or were, they needed to know Nepali and be fluent in Nepali in order to deal with things like taxation and land tenure and land disputes and any interaction with the Nepalese government. They needed Nepali, so they all could speak fine in Nepali. With the women, it was harder because especially those who had never left the village and never been to school, they could speak Nepali, but it wasn't their first choice, and it was more broken. And so we'd have conversations in Nepali, and I think probably each of us, you know, I have no idea how much each of us actually understood about what we were talking about. And that was with some of the older women, mostly. Younger women who are going to school more could speak Nepali fine.
But you became pretty close with people, even with an older woman, a grandmother.
Yes.
Talk about that closeness. What had to happen with you? I mean, they must have changed and your relationship changed, but did something in you change also that enabled you to bridge the distance?
That's a good question. I think as I became more relaxed about understanding just what I could understand with words, and then this grandmother would, when I would come back to the village after I'd been away, she would come right over and grab my hands and dance with me around in the mud courtyard and chant this sort of very sing-songy chant. And other times I'd go to her house to see her, and we'd sit with one candle that I would bring because she didn't have any kerosene. She didn't have money to buy kerosene for a light. And she would tell me these stories, and I would take as much from her animation and her gestures and her facial expressions as I would from her actual words. And so in an anthropological sense, like what I would write up about that encounter, it wasn't so much about that gathering research information and more just this connection with her. I hesitate to use the word friendship, but it just an opening for both of us, I think, and reaching across.
Now, why do you hesitate to use the word friendship?
I think Himali, whom I called Devi Maya in the book, who's a younger woman in her 20s, and Rajkumar, who is a younger man who had lived for a year or two in Kathmandu and helped me some with my research. I think with them I would call friends. I think with friendship, is there an exchange? I don't know. I don't know if I can answer that question.
Well, let me ask it in a different way then. You know, there's this kind of central tenet of anthropology that the anthropologist is not supposed to go native, so to speak. First, could you tell us what does that mean, and what do you think of that idea?
Mm-hmm. I think the fear of going native. What it's like losing. In anthropology, the main way you get research is participant observation. And so it's going native when you lose the observer stance and you're just completely participating and losing. But it's not just that. It's I haven't thought about this question in so long. It's giving up your own cultural, who you are and where you come from, and just taking on another set of beliefs and practices that aren't coming from your own cultural tradition, where you're from, losing that grounding, I think. And so then the second part of your question was what I thought of that.
Yeah.
It's interesting, when I went back to Nepal, I think part of the fear of going native is, you know, there's a tension in anthropology about having an impact in the community where you live. You know, if you're a participant in observation, you participate, but you're always on the outside somehow, and you don't want to change the community, or that was the sort of expectation passed down. And, of course, that's changing, and anthropologists don't expect that that's the case, because every encounter leads to some shift or transformation. But I think this fear of going native, it's maybe in me, because I went to Nepal looking to find out about land tenure and their experience and perceptions of this conservation project, but also really looking for answers to questions I had in my own life. And I think, so maybe I was particularly aware of my own version of what it would mean to go native, which would be embracing some answer to a question that wasn't, I'm not answering this very well.
You're doing fine.
Fear of giving up who I was as an American. And maybe I was especially prone to that, so I was more aware of it, even as the last time I went back to Hiranga, and I talk about this in the book, Devi Maya's fiancé had been killed a few weeks before I came. And so I gave up trying to do any sort of research and just was there as a friend, and or tried to be there in whatever way I thought could offer her some comfort. And, yeah, I'm at an end point there.
And, well, it sounds to me, it seems to me that your book, Thin Places, is really all about relationships. And you just pointed out, you know, in anthropology, you're supposed to participate but be an observer, basically stand apart. And this is something, it seems, that you really struggled with in the book. You know, you've, and even perhaps still struggle with, as you've been, you know, struggling to answer the question, what is the place where you connect with people without overwhelming or presuming or contaminating the relationship as an anthropologist?
Mm-hmm.
Is that too big a question?
No, and I think that your question about friendship, I think that without, you know, my fear in saying, oh, we're friends, that feels like I'm projecting my, you know, I'm overwhelming that relationship with this category of a friendship rather than just this opening and a connection in a moment in time. And I think, before I went to do research, I went to speak with William Cronin, an American historian at Yale, who was teaching at Yale at the time. And as I left, right before I left his office, he said, we all have black boxes through which we perceive the world. And if what you encounter in Nepal doesn't fit into your black box, get rid of the box, not that information. And I think I was able to do that as a researcher, but then when I came back to write about what I had experienced, I found I climbed back into that black box and became the observer writing about these encounters, the connections with people. And it was only later, several years later, at a writing workshop with Terry Tempest Williams, when I was still trying to write just about Nepal, and she knew about the trip I had taken around the United States, and she knew about the unraveling of my marriage, and she said, I think all of these are part of the story, and you are the main character in that story. And I realized, at first I resisted that, but she presented it in a way as sort of a challenge, like if you really want to talk about our connection, connections with people, connection with the land, that you really need to get back out of that black box. Those weren't her words, but get back out of the black box and into the field with the men and women in Hedungna that I came to know. And I think that's when the book maybe shifted away from talking about these ideas about land tenure or their connection with the ancestors, and more became something more about my encounters with these different individuals in Hedungna and then coming home and back in the United States.
We're talking with Anne Armbrecht about her memoir, Thin Places, A Pilgrimage Home. So you title your memoir Thin Places, and it is a beautiful, beautifully written and starkly honest book. So I'm very glad you put yourself into the story. Why did you entitle it Thin Places?
I think I first thought of the idea of thinness from a quotation by Virginia Woolf that I start the book with. There are moments when the walls of my mind grow thin, when nothing is unabsorbed. And then, so this idea of thinness, of the place between worlds, where we perceive more than what our eyes can see. And then in Nepal, in Hedungna, as I moved from looking at land tenure and talking more to the shamans and priests, all of the work that the priests and shamans do in the village is about traveling into the world of the ancestors and bringing something back, whether that could be a lost soul, it could be what they call charawa, which is this essence from the ancestors that goes into the grain. And so they fill their rice bins not just with the physical grain, but it has this quality from the ancestors that makes that grain last a long time. And so the priests and shamans see what they say, Akadabla, which is with double eyes. So they can see what the eyes can see and beyond what the eyes can see. And so the idea of thin places to me is where we let ourselves be open to what's beyond what we've, in my case, have been ingrained to see was real. And it also then refers to the Celtic idea of the thin place between worlds, where the veil between worlds is lifted and you can experience the sacred.
So you, as you say, you got very... I'm going to start over on that. So it sounds to me what you're saying is that the shamans are talking not only... are talking about seeing in a different way. I think at some point in the book you talk about seeing with a heart. Could you say, well, you went on a pilgrimage, a physical pilgrimage, also to a place called Kembalung. Am I pronouncing that right?
Kembalung. Mm-hmm.
Kembalung. Tell us about that pilgrimage, and did this pilgrimage also, in what way did this change you? Did this bring you closer, perhaps, to seeing with a heart?
So this pilgrimage is one that all sorts of villagers from this part of Nepal, Hindus, Buddhists, and Kharati, sort of on the border between those two, travel up to these caves and then the base of Makalu, the lake at the base of Makalu on the full moon of August. And pilgrimages like this take place throughout the Himalayas at this time of year to these lakes that are high in the mountains. And this, on the way, we went to these, what they call the Kembalung Caves, which also refer to the Bayuls in Tibetan cosmology, these sort of sacred, pure lands that have been set aside from the destruction of time. And so you can take a physical pilgrimage there, or then yogis and priests can travel there through religious practice and meditation. We traveled there by foot, and I went with, I think, 25 or 30 villagers during the height of the monsoon, and this is a very wet part of Nepal. So the trail was quite wet and muddy and slippery, and my boots were wet the whole time. They're all going barefoot, and my boots were soggy, and my socks were soggy, and so the skin started to peel off my feet. On the second morning, I had taken off my boots, and just I'd never had it happen before. The skin was just falling off in flaps. But I was the only one with that problem, and so I had to quickly put my boots back on and continue on the way. And we traveled up to, for 3 or 4 days, I think, sleeping in caves, and traveled up to Yangli Meadow, which is just below these caves that are up this rock face, sort of towering above the valley floor. And the villagers in Hirungna go there to ask for a variety of things. A lot of people go to ask for a child, especially a son, or they ask for a good harvest or a money, or if a child wants a job in the Nepali government, they ask for some very concrete something from the caves, and they bring offerings that express that. So people asking for a child would bring these tiny little pieces of clothing that they'd have the tailors in the village make, and they'd bring those up and leave them at the base of the cliff, or at the base of the cave. So then we woke early in the morning and climbed up this rock face, which was quite steep, and I was terrified. And I know how to rock climb, and so I think I was terrified for good reason. But they all just went up ahead. There were three women who were probably in their 60s or 70s who were climbing up by my side, and they kept telling me I should go down, that it was not safe enough. But this older man who was sort of our guide would pull me up over the hard parts. And should I keep talking, or do you want to ask another question?
Oh, no, this is... Please keep talking.
Okay. So then we got up to the caves, and there's this huge, towering cave. I'd never seen anything like it. And this water pours out of the top of it. And one of the villagers pointed up to it and said, "We have no idea where that water comes from, and that's why this is a sacred place, because we can't explain that." As the stories go, that is where Shiva supposedly bathed before he married Parvati. And that's in the Hindu cosmology, and the Buddhists believe that Padmasambhava meditated here. And so then the villagers, we would all walk through that torrent of water pouring down, and they immersed themselves in this shower of freezing cold water, and I sort of skirted around the edges. And then we went up to the base of the cave, and there were about 60 people up there at this point, because all sorts of other villagers were climbing up on the same morning, and everybody was there hanging prayer flags and lighting butter lamps and placing their offerings of clothing for children or little bangles, or some brought copy notebooks, all to ask the god of the rock to bring the child. Or some would come back to thank the god for giving them a child because they had come in the past and had, in fact, gone home and gotten pregnant. And so everybody made their offerings, and it was focused, and it was beautiful. You could look down, and the Barun River snaked its way down the valley, this green valley, which is grazing lands for Sherpas who live in villages below. And then we climbed down, climbed back down. Most of the time up at the cave, I was preoccupied thinking about how I would get down the rock face. And we made our way back down, and then we packed up our belongings and continued up the valley to the base of Makalu, where we bathed the next morning. We spent the night in another cave, and then we bathed early the next morning in the water at the base of Makalu.
I'm going to stop you there and ask you, do you have the book by you there?
I do, yeah.
Okay, I'd love you to read a section, a page from your, from talking about this pilgrimage to Kembalung. It starts on page 90. It's not too long, but, you know, it's not exactly a couple of sentences either. So if you could start on the, another day, long day walking, mm-hmm. on page 90, and then go over to, I'm thinking over to the top of 91, but I might even ask you to read a little bit more of that next section as well. How's that?
Okay.
Okay, thanks.
Another long day walking in misty rain, another night sleeping in yet another cave. There had been a confusion over a bag I had left with the grandmothers, whom, we now discovered, had decided to head home before us. One of the women reprimanded me for not taking responsibility for my belongings. A man who had told me the previous day to leave the extra weight looked at me with disdain and said that he had told me he would carry the bag. I turned away and walked to the river's edge to fill my water bottle. It was dusk, and the sky still was overcast. I stood on the banks of the Barun River alone. I thought about how hard I was trying to get it right, to walk fast enough, to say the right thing, to understand the right way. In Hadangna, I had novels to read and a tiny room with a door that I could shut, a door that, oddly enough, protected me from this stark realization of my solitude. For the past few days, these barriers had been stripped away, and this sudden and complete exposure made me acutely aware of the gap between my world and that of my companions. I stared at the cold, gray rapids thundering through the cold, gray fog. Why was I here alone in the middle of nowhere? Why did I keep going out on my own into the wind and the rain and the wet? I inhaled the cold, moist air and searched the shadows beneath the Kembalung caves, searched the thick fir trees clinging to the edge of the valley floor. The mist moved swiftly and silently along the banks of the Barun. The silty river roared. Then the cloud suddenly opened, and a shaft of light broke through the fog, turning the gray water to silver, the black fir to deep green. An angular cliff appeared out of the clouds high overhead. Just as suddenly, the fog closed over, and night set in. I took a deep breath, turned, and walked back to help prepare dinner. In the cave, a young woman approached me to say that, unlike me, the other pilgrims were there with their families and neighbors, that it was as though they had never left home. They forgot that I was alone, and she realized that sometimes I must feel lonely or homesick and hope that I was okay. During the trip, I felt an ache in my chest, a longing that would not go away. I thought there must be a place somewhere where I could be held, here on the inside. As soon as I arrived at that place, I was sure the yearning would disappear. Now I realized that the longing would never go away. It was what had brought me here, to one of the thinnest places I had ever encountered. It was what let me know that I was on the right path, what kept me walking even as the skin peeled off my feet. It was what let me experience the sacred.
And we're talking with Anne Armbrecht. Her memoir is Thin Places, A Pilgrimage Home. It's, among other things, a story of a sojourn in Nepal and how that changed her. Now, in you say in the next paragraph, you say, longing begets belonging. And you refer here, too, to your sense of being insider, well, to be outsider, and then the connection that you make. Could you explain that idea that longing begets belonging?
That's a nice question. I think it's how I understand that is when you're inside an experience, like I was following... When I was inside the experience of following that longing, I found that I belonged. If I stepped outside and when I was trying, then I would become more aware of the distance between us and what the differences, I guess. And in that same paragraph, I refer back to what a grandmother had once told me when we were watching a cremation by the side of the Arun River, and she held up her hand, which was dark and wrinkled and brown and gnarled, and she said, "We all feel pain. We all feel love. It is only the oral traditions that are different." And so I think longing begets belonging when helps me remember when I just follow from the living from the inside out, I guess. I found the connections that I was looking for.
Christian's going to ask a question.
I was very moved by your description of standing by the river. And as a writer, I also wondered, how did that description come to be? Did you write notes about it when you were back in the cave? Did you wait till you were back in the village or back in the States? What allowed you to recreate that image of the river and the changing light?
I took lots of notes. I mean, that was more, you know, journal kind of. That sort of writing, I took notes the whole time, so I have tons of bound journals, and that was the source of that.
Oh, I'm sorry. And I just want to follow up on that. You took many journals. You took many notes for your journals. Did you find... You wrote a very different kind of book than the one that you probably originally intended while you were keeping those journals. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Did you find that you had missed something because you thought you were going to write a different kind of book? I mean, were there gaps in the kind of notes you took? Or did you, in fact, find when you went back to your notes that you were prefiguring the book that you ended up actually writing?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Well, I think when I just answered that previous question and I said that was in a journal, there was ones where I would just write how I was feeling, and then I would divide that into the notebooks that were filled with interview, transcriptions of interviews and observations that were what I drew on much more for my dissertation. And so in part I went back and I found that I did have a lot of the information, though. A lot of it was in the more personal journals that I would draw on. But I also, after finishing my doctorate, I went back to Hiraungna in 97, this time thinking that I was there more as a writer and less as an anthropologist and more to gather the details I had missed. And it was so many of the specific details, like what people were wearing and description of the village and in a way that would bring it alive and let someone who wasn't there really see it. The things that I just took for granted, I found I hadn't written down. And I was just teaching a writing workshop, and after I had everyone in the class write a description, it brought the same awareness of how little they had noticed when you're looking for information and ideas and content rather than recreating a scene or recreating a character. You know, in anthropology, people talk about informants, and the informants are the people who are the source of the information. But when I was writing Thin Places, they weren't informants, they were people, and they were characters in the story I was trying to tell, and that requires a different kind of detail. So some of that was in what I had, and some I would recapture by doing a lot of free writes around the different people whom I write a lot about to try and remember what I hadn't written down.
It seems to me what you're describing is also the difference between the place you started, the place you ended up, also the difference between how the villagers see the relationships within which they live and their relationship to their world and to their land, and how the conservationists who were doing this development project saw their work, which was more akin to kind of how the anthropologist sees their work. Could you talk about, there's an example of this project to redo a shrine, and you go fairly deeply, well, in the book Thin Places, you go into the approach that the conservationists have and some of the problems with it. Could you talk about that, particularly in the context of this project that was done and how it, you know, how it turned out for the villagers?
Mm-hmm. One thing I do want to say about the conservation project is when I was there, it was in the very early stages of the project, and they made some mistakes and they learned from those mistakes. I think questions of scale, they began to work on a much smaller scale and more directly with the villagers than they were when I was there. The big question, though, that I was thinking about and still struggle with is in a conservation project, they were addressing a separation between the people and the land. They were trying to reconnect. Or is it a disconnection that we experience here? We protect wild places. In Nepal, it was all connected and overlapping. I didn't express that very clearly. I'll try by talking about the Tsawa. The Tsawa is a place in the village that had been built to honor the founding of the village, where this lake that had dried up into a spring, which is the lake from which the founding fathers of the village first drank when they came to Adungna, and they drank from that lake and swore that this would be their home. And it's a beautiful stone resting platform, similar to the ones found throughout Nepal, but this is larger, and there were five stone pillars in the pool of water that still remained, from which villagers would get drinking water. And it was shaded by these huge trees that it was forbidden to cut. And the part of this cultural preservation project that the conservation project introduced was to improve the water, improve the Tsawa, and they built, I'm not quite sure why it was happened this way, but they built five cement water spouts at the site of the shrine and a cement water tank. And when I last went to the village, this had already been implemented. And Rajkumar told me before I got there that I wouldn't like it. And he said that the money had gone, I think school teachers who weren't from the village were the ones who were in charge of implementing the project. And it wasn't done well. And the school teachers used the money for something else, which is what often happens. And another villager in Hadangna told me they didn't care what happened because it they didn't get any money from it anyway. And so the day that I was at the, I went to visit the Tsawa, there was a woman gathering water from the stone, the cement spigot, and there was trash suddenly hanging around, floating around the water, which hadn't been there before. And I asked her what she thought of it, and she said, oh, the water was better, because now it came through a cement spout instead of the just pouring through the stone. And it just raised so many questions for me, because for me, it seemed the loss of something that had been beautiful, but maybe it wasn't for them. You know, some of that was because I realized, you know, it's a hard part of Westerners going to a place like Nepal, and we need it to hold something in our imagination, or to, even while we destroy the places where we live, we want there to, or I want there to be some pure place that I think is somehow not destroyed, but that's my own idea. And so for me, that was a turning point in that I realized I needed to be, I could, just the limits of what I could do, that this place meant something else to them. And I think often in conservation, we have ideas that we project and want to implement, and we think they're the right thing, but there's other people with other ideas, and it's so challenging to work with those different perspectives and needs and values and ideas about what we want and aspirations. I don't know if I answered your question.
Yeah, you did. Well, I mean, it seems to me that your book is really all about relationships. Maybe I already said that. And it was in through working through those relationships, and one relationship we haven't even talked about yet, and that is a relationship with your husband. As you mentioned before, there was in fact a slow unraveling of that relationship that really began when you first went to Nepal, and it seemed to founder in many ways on your own deepening understanding of what relationship means as a result of your experience in Nepal. Could you talk about how that happened? And am I being too general? I mean, do you need me to rephrase questions?
Maybe, can you rephrase that?
Okay.
If you can be more specific, then I can answer more specific.
Okay.
Maybe.
I like to ask open-ended questions, but sometimes they're too open-ended. your relationship with your husband deteriorated, and it began to deteriorate when you were in Nepal, when it seemed like you were beginning to learn some of the lessons that you talk about in the book. Lessons about seeing with the heart, about going beyond kind of agendas to see more deeply and to process. I wonder if you could talk about your evolution in your understanding of relationship, which seems to center so much around this idea of thin places and pilgrimages and what they do for you. Is that more specific?
Mm-hmm. And actually once, when I was trying to, working on one of the many drafts of this book, my husband, who I'm called Brian in the book, said that what I was really trying to write about was the thin places, the places where I could touch the villagers and they could, you know, the places where we touched each other. I think it's hard to answer that question specifically around my relationship.
Any way you'd like to.
Yeah. Let me talk about it some that might get to the same question by thinking about why I wrote about my relationship in the first place, which was because I was trying to talk about our connection to the land and why we do what we do. You know, we know what we need to do to stop destroying the land, and yet it seems to me we keep not doing it, or we don't do it as effectively as we could. And so it seems that something, we're not paying attention to something, or that something else is called for. And I found parallels in my relationship with Brian. It's also about intimacy. You know, it's how we open to another person, how we're able to let them be an other with a capital O rather than an object that we fit for our own purposes. And I think that's, again, circling around on this idea of being in the thin place and being present to the unknown, which is what's expressed in another person. And so I think the story of my relationship with Brian, it was sort of our missing each other in that way, trying to make the other person fit what we needed them to be. And then once it became clear that we were going to get a divorce, I think what happened in my experience in a divorce, in order to make yourself feel good, you have to make the other person all bad. And you have to I had to forget the good parts of our relationship. And there were many good parts. And just remember the bad in order to sort of because that was what happened. And it just made me think about, well, what would it take to make room for both the good parts and the bad parts, both in myself and in Brian? I once heard Peter Matheson quote Solzhenitsyn, and he said, the line through good and evil cuts through each of our hearts. And then that he continued to say, who of us is willing to cut out our own heart? And so I'm talking about my relationship with Brian and talking about our relationship to the land. It seems we have both capacity for connection and also for isolation and hurting. And we have to make room for both, both in how we interact with each other and how we interact with the land.
So you're connecting our relationships with our loved ones, with our relationship to the land and our world around us.
Yes.
Now, I want to ask you maybe an even more personal question. In your memoir, and you don't have to answer it if you don't want to, in your memoir, when you talk about the relationship with Brian, there's a certain point, years after you've come back from your first trip to Nepal, where Brian, you find out that he's been having an affair. And it hurts you deeply. You feel betrayed. And you still try to make the marriage work for a while longer. But you, earlier, when you were in Nepal, also had an affair, a passionate relationship with a man who you felt really understood you in a way that Brian didn't. So I just wonder, how did you, at the time when you found out about Brian's affair, how did you reconcile that with your own knowledge of your own affair? And did your view also change, you know, after your divorce? I mean, do you feel differently about it now?
I think I think, and this is sort of what I was trying to say when I answered the previous, when I was speaking a moment before about, it's hard. It's hard to make a marriage work. It's hard to find the right way to live on the land. And nobody has all the answers, and we all make mistakes. And I find I learn more by understanding how people deal with the compromises they make, the places they fall short, the affairs that you have, the ways you don't live up to the ideal. Somehow, not because that makes those mistakes or affairs or broken promises okay, not because it justifies them, but because it helps understand the places where we're all maybe not who we want to imagine ourselves to be. and helps me find a way to go forward or understand those parts of myself rather than trying to sweep them under the carpet and pretend they're not there, that I've done things I never thought I would do. Rather than demonizing myself for that, how do I learn from that and create a relationship that is open and honest? And to answer your question, I guess that's what I imagined trying to do with Brian. It was less that we'd both done what we promised the other we wouldn't do, and more, how could we understand that and move forward with that understanding?
Now, somebody is trying to tell me something here. I'm going to have to stop for just a minute. Do you mind holding on for a minute while I find out? And also, I want to invite you, Christian, if you'd like to talk a bit while I go find out what's going on. So I'm going to put up Christian's mic and mine down.
Hi. The last date you gave as we were talking was 1997. And I wondered what you thought of developments in Nepal in the years since then, and how closely you've been following them.
Yeah, I haven't been following it very closely, so I don't. I can't really answer that. You know, I think the civil war hit the part of Nepal I was in very hard, and I haven't been able to be in touch with what's happened.
So you haven't, in fact, you haven't been able to retain a connection with those folks since 1997.
I was connected on email for a while, and then the internet service went down, and I lost the addresses. The addresses no longer worked that I had with Rajkumar and Devi Maya. And I've tried to get them again, and I haven't been able to. And I'm sure I could try harder. I haven't been able to, though.
Thank you so much.
So now you came back to the United States and you became a mother, and that profoundly changed you, as it does, I think, probably all of us, I can safely say, who have that experience. But it also really changed you in ways that fit right into the theme of this book, of relationship. Not only to another human being, but also to the world around us. So, I mean, I just loved, as a mother and as just a human being reading your book, I loved your passages about that. Tell us a little bit about becoming a mother.
Oh, well, thank you. Let me see. Well, it's interesting, you know, Kristen's question about whether I'd stayed in touch in Nepal. And I found, since having this book come out, suddenly people ask me a lot about Nepal, whereas the book, in a way, is an actual pilgrimage, and I've continued traveling, and it's taken me away somewhat from Nepal, in large part by becoming a mother. And I found that the qualities that were awoken in me in Nepal about perceiving more than the eyes can see were right there as a mother, you know, where you don't use words, but it's touch and, you know, that thing that flows between, you know, hearts and the open heart. And found that it was my daughter sort of continuing leading me further down on this journey. That, and I describe a scene when I took her back to these anthropology conferences, and I was giving a paper on finding home, and I was finding most of my home in that moment, following her down the carpeted hallways rather than going into the talks where the anthropologists were talking about the things that I thought I was there to discuss and engage in the ideas.
And you were having a lot more fun with her.
I was having a lot more fun with her, yeah. Yes.
You know, using that term, finding home, I wrote a memoir, which is not published because my radio work is completely overwhelmed every aspect of my life. But I wrote a memoir of a time that I spent in Provence. And I called it, my first working title was Finding Home. And now I'm calling it Province of the Heart, actually. And I could really relate to your idea of what home means. Tell us what that is.
You know, when I went to Nepal and since, I was looking for a home, a physical place in the landscape, where suddenly I would walk in the door and everything would fall into place. And by the end of the book, I found it was much more a way of being in the world, more a verb and less a noun. And in Hedungna, the women rub mud. They live in stone and mud houses, and they have to rub mud on the inside of the walls once a month, or the walls start to crack. And so just that act of rubbing mud inside the house once a month, you know, it's the actions that create the feeling of home. Or in the story of the founding of Hedungna, there are these two brothers, and they're traveling down the Arun River following a wooden bowl and walking stick that are underneath the ground, traveling underneath the ground. And as they travel, the stories say, watching, watching, walking, walking. And that idea of paying attention, close attention to the world they're traveling through, to the seen and the unseen, and having an intention of finding a home. And I find those two qualities that come out a lot with mothering, or have come a lot for me in mothering. Paying attention to my children, seeing them as an other with a capital O, and having the intention of connecting with them. And so I create these moments, or we create these, or these moments are created where we connect, and that feels like home to me. It's like the moment is a home.
Well, Anne Armbreth, thank you so much for talking with us here and for writing this beautiful memoir, Thin Places.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed talking with you.
It was a great joy to listen to you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.